Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Welcome back to another episode of Three Guys Theologizing. My name is Kyle, and today I am happy that 3GT is living up to its name, and that is because all three of us are here. I am joined with my regular co-host, Barry York, and Esquire Scott Hunt. Scott, that's the proper, right? You're an Esquire because
I am an Esquire.
You have a doctorate, right? Yeah.
That is
so
right.
So you don't get a doctorate, you're just an Esquire?
Well, some pretentious lawyers do go by doctor, but not me.
Okay. You are pretentious. You just don't.
I am pretentious. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Some of the other pretentious lawyers go by doctor.
All right. Good to know. So, but it is good to be back with you guys. Of course, sometimes 3GT is a little hit and miss with our busy schedules, but I am glad to be sitting around the table to theologize with you guys. But actually, I might need to amend a little bit of what I said. I said that we were living up to our name of Three Guys Theologizing, but actually today we are Four Guys Theologizing. We are welcoming to our episode today, Pastor Daniel Howe. I'm going to spare any real introduction of him because I'm going to let him introduce himself here in a moment. But Daniel has recently written a book that we want to put in the spotlight. The book is part of the Grass Market imprint. For those of our regular listeners, you know that we have interviewed a couple of other authors in the Grass Market imprint. Crown and Covenant Publications, which is the publishing arm of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, launched an imprint titled Grass Market. It is named after the Grass Market in Edinburgh, Scotland, where the Covenanters were persecuted, where they were executed for the Christian faith and for maintaining the crown rights of Jesus Christ. Grass Market Press, as part of Crown and Covenant, is an imprint that aims to communicate the doctrine and the worship and the piety or the godliness of the Westminster Confession of Faith to a general audience. The goal of Grass Market Press is to appeal to your average everyday person, maybe with a particular focus on normal men, men who may not even enjoy reading all of the time. We have, of course, in previous episodes, interviewed Nathan Eshelman for his book, I Have a Confession. And today we get the privilege of interviewing Daniel Howe on his book. Daniel has also been, I don't know if he would admit it, but I'm going to admit it for him. Daniel has been very influential with the Grass Market Press imprint. Together with his wife, Esther, they have done a ton of work behind the scenes to help brainstorm and bring to fruition this project. So we're doubly blessed to have Daniel with us today, and just want to thank you, Daniel, for taking time to join us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's jump in then. I didn't give much of an introduction, so Daniel, I'll open the door to you. Just for our listeners, can you introduce us a little bit to yourself, your life, and your ministry?
Sure. So I am pastor of Christ Reformed Presbyterian Church in Riverside, Rhode Island, which is part of East Providence. You probably won't be able to find it on a map all by itself, but it's part of East Providence. And I've been pastor here since 2007, when I was ordained to be a church planting associate as part of First RP in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So basically, I've been here for coming up on 16 years. And my wife, Esther, and I live in nearby Warren, Rhode Island, and we have five kids, ages 3 to almost 20. I am a graduate of the Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh, and although before Barry was a professor there, so I didn't have his wisdom, I had the wisdom of other men.
That mean your education was subpar?
My education was actually suitable to what I needed.
Perfect. What a political answer.
It is a very political answer. No, I had great people I went to school with and learned from. And I actually grew up in the Reformed Presbyterian Church. I grew up in the Oswego, New York congregation. So when I was a youngster, I was baptized in Syracuse when I was one, when my parents, as pretty new Christians, came into the Syracuse RP Church. They went into Oswego County, New York, to be part of the new church plant there. Kit Swartz was my pastor all through my growing up years, and in a church plant in upstate New York. So my wife Esther is from New England. I married a New England girl and loved New England and wanted to be. I wanted a church plant in urban New England, and we had the opportunity to do that. And so, with a core group a number of years ago, we started doing that, and the Lord's been with us. So that's sort of the broad outlines. That's what I'm all about.
That's really helpful. Appreciate that. For listeners who were on the edge of their seats being introduced to Daniel, you can hear even more about him at the podcast of our friends titled The Blue Banter. I believe Daniel was interviewed by The Blue Banter on April 18th. And so if you want to be introduced more thoroughly to this man, go listen to that interview. That was a shameless plug for the Blue Banter podcast, which, of course, is a competitive podcast. So, well, good. Well, Daniel, let's get into your book then. You have written on the topic of the Lord's Day. So as Grass Market Press has really begun, as I said, we've interviewed Nathan Eshelman, who wrote I Have a Confession on the Westminster Confession of Faith. Barry and Scott did me the favor of interviewing me on a book that I tried to write titled What is Love? God's Answer to Humanity's Question. I feel like I have to put the subtitle in there before people's minds go to the 1990s hit, which is actually topping the charts once again. Daniel, you have taken the Grass Market imprint in the direction with this latest publication on the Lord's Day, which is a wonderful, wonderful topic to think through. Before we get into the contents of the book, can you give us a little bit of the background? Why is it that you chose to write specifically on the Lord's Day?
Well, yeah, so there's sort of a general component to that, and then there's a personal component to that. The general component, I heard a while back that you can kind of approach tasks in one of two ways. You can either go to the refrigerator and open it and say, what do I want to eat? Or you can go to the refrigerator and open it and say, what needs to be eaten? And taking on the Sabbath as a topic, I felt like was the appropriate thing to do because it was something that needed to be eaten. It's a tough topic and a controversial topic, which I'll talk about in a second. I ran into myself for sure. I felt like there was a general need, and I had a concern that a lot of conversations that I was around concerning the Sabbath, and certainly some of the tone of the Westminster documents, not to bang on them too much, but when you're reading the Westminster documents, you're overhearing one side of a very heated conversation from the 17th century. And so there's a lot of talk about what you may and may not do. And I felt like there was a need to make the focus a little bit more on what we get to do as what shapes our understanding of the Lord's Day or the Sabbath. So that's kind of the general need. The personal component of it is I actually kind of got myself in trouble over this a number of years ago. I preached a sermon in which I actually disagreed with the Westminster standards. And one of my church members quite correctly took me to task over it. And so after consulting with my resident ruling elder, we said, well, let's ask the presbytery what the presbytery thinks. And the presbytery said, you shouldn't have done that. And we're going to appoint one of those committees to counsel you. Now, thankfully, this committee was not looking for evidence to hang me with and did a really good really good job of encouraging me to rethink some of the things I'd expressed and actually to give some fresh thought if necessary. My wife tells me that I reinvent the wheel all the time. And so maybe I was doing that a little bit, but I do think that it was helpful. It was very helpful for me as a person and as a believer in thinking about my own understanding and practice. But of course, that leads pretty naturally when you're an elder or pastor So it was very helpful for me as a elder, as a pastor, and then eventually writing a book on the topic, because I did have to dig in way more into it than I otherwise would have. I wrote the book really with a sense that in order to understand the Sabbath, you actually need to look at it from some angles that are a little bit different from where we usually go. So I think it's pretty natural and understandable to kind of start out trying to think about the Sabbath by going straight to Genesis, right? It's the very beginning of the Bible and introduces the Sabbath. But I actually think it's a little bit more helpful to start out by looking at Exodus. And the reason I say it's more helpful is when you are looking at the ancient Israelites who first received the law of Moses, their lived out experience, the thing that they were most familiar with, was not anything in the book of Genesis. It was all the stuff in the early chapters of Exodus, right? They had lived as slaves in Egypt. They had been taken out by the Lord. They'd witnessed all these miracles. They were the ones coming to Mount Sinai, receiving the law of Moses, and then in the subsequent years, having that sort of unpacked in all the various commandments and regulations. They were the ones building the tabernacle. And so the sort of lived out experience of Israel is that experience of the Exodus, and that actually forms the first or the most urgent and practical backdrop of the Sabbath commandment. And then Moses gives the book of Genesis. Genesis is really the prequel to Exodus. But Exodus really does a really good job, I think, of helping us understand the setting and the need for the Sabbath, not just in the ancient world in the land of Egypt, but also in the modern world. And it really portrays, the scriptures really portray Egypt as this sort of empire of production and anxiety and restlessness. And the Sabbath is very much a theological answer to that anxiety of Egypt. And so everything I'm saying, I hope in the book is actually kind of flowing from that awareness that the Sabbath is God's answer to the restlessness of the world, not just the ancient world, but to our world as well.
Yeah. So that's a great springboard for where I wanted to go in this episode. I mean, one, you know that I've read your book. I was one of the theological editors. I love this book. I think to circle back to something you said, I think you're right that oftentimes the emphasis, at least in many of our circles, falls on what can you do, what can't you do. And I do love the pastoral flavor of this book, that the Sabbath is about what we get to do. You know, it's that winsome approach, not to make Barry blush. But I remember when I was being introduced to the RPCNA, we had Barry and Miriam over, and I was wrestling with some of the distinctives, and Barry emphasized something very pastorally similar to that with me. You know, it's not a matter of having to do this and that. It's what we get to do. And I think that is the tenor of this book, which, as I am encouraging people to read it, that's one of the major things. As I said, you know, I think Daniel has done a good job not only presenting what we get to do, but cultivating a desire to then do it. So you talk about in your book, and you started getting there, but I want you to flesh this out a little bit for our listeners. You talk about how addressing the why. And before I go on with that question, Barry, go ahead.
Have we given the title of the book yet? Because I think that it emphasizes what you're talking about.
Yeah, the title turned out to be extremely straightforward, which because it's sort of the big headings for the practical aspects of the book. And the title of the book is Worship, Feasting, Rest, Mercy. And the subtitle is The Christian Sabbath, because I really do think these are sort of the big headings of what our understanding of the Sabbath is to be focused on. And they really help each other. If you don't mind me talking about this for a second, they really shed light on each other. I don't think you can understand biblical rest without worship, because rest always centers on worship. Every day off that we take is a day off in honor of something or someone. Rest is not just cessation of labor, but it's actually enjoyment of the fruit of our labor. And so there's always this feasting component whenever you have a Sabbath of any kind, not just the weekly Sabbath, but the various holidays of ancient Israel, those always practically always center or have a huge feasting component. And then also that restlessness leads to slavery. That's that motif of the life of Egypt. That's that way of Egypt that is alive and well in our day. Restlessness always leads to slavery. But the flip side of that is that Sabbath and Sabbath rest is sort of the beginning or sort of the gateway of mercy in a lot of ways. And what you see in the Old Testament is that you have this this connection that shows up over and over again, particularly, although not well, in the Law and the Prophets, I should say, between Sabbath rest and mercy of various kinds, and Sabbath breaking and oppression of various kinds. And so these things are really all intimately tied together. And I think that when we try to, a lot of the times the debates that we have about the Sabbath kind of focus on what exactly does rest mean? And they tend to assume worship is happening, and they kind of throw out or ignore the feasting aspect, and they throw out or ignore the mercy aspect. So I did think that those four components, and you could rearrange them if you wanted to. There's nothing, you know, particularly awesome about putting them in that order. But worship, feasting, rest, and mercy really do kind of summarize what our Sabbaths are to be about.
Yeah, no, that's good. You made multiple references, and in your book you note that it's the priority of the question in some sense should be why Sabbath before we get to the how. And you've already been alluding to this, but I'd love to hear you tease this out a little more, because I think this is one of the great strengths of the book, together with everything you just said, which we'll get more into. But when you deal with the why, you've already talked a little bit about what you've called the way of Egypt. In your book, you call Egypt the empire of anxiety. You've noted that a very restless nation, and one that is still very much alive and well today. Walk us through that. Like when you look at the biblical text and you're saying Egypt is a place of anxiety and restlessness, what does that mean? What does that look like? And how do you see that manifesting still, that spirit manifesting today?
So I honestly can't remember if Empire of Anxiety is my phrase or if
Walter Brueggemann's phrase.
Okay, it is Walter Brueggemann's phrase.
Wasn't going to bring that part up.
I think it's a really helpful phrase. His book is a great book, as with all of Walter Brueggemann's writings. Like, it's really great, and then it's really not, and then it's really great again, then it's not. Yeah. But the concept of Egypt as an empire of anxiety is a very powerful one especially when you start to unpack kind of the details of the book of Exodus. For instance, it's fascinating, of all of the different public works that we would like to hear about, like, okay, so the ancient Israelites are slaves in Egypt. Egypt is the place with the greatest monuments, like truly ancient monuments in the world. I don't think there's any contest about that. And yet we don't read about anything cool that the Israelites built. Like, there's just a piece of us that kind of itches. You know, we need Cecil B. DeMille to step in and tell us that they were building the Sphinx or the pyramids or whatever. But it only mentions actually one public works project that they worked on, and that was the store cities of Pithom and Ramses, which is really interesting because it actually paints a picture of Egypt as in some ways better run than our modern nations, right? So we have nations that are built on debt. We're just having right now in 2023, we're having this argument over raising the debt ceiling so that the US can borrow even more trillions of dollars. Egypt was better run than the United States. They weren't borrowing anything. They were storing more. They had really learned their lesson, I would say, from what we see in the late chapters of Genesis, when Joseph is helping the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to basically confiscate the land of Egypt and create what was more or less a command economy. It's not something that we would actually be very comfortable with, particularly those of us who aren't interested in being socialists or communists. And so here's Egypt, this centrally planned, centrally run, powerful state where Pharaoh owns everything. Pharaoh is divine. Nobody has very much private property, or at least not the Israelites. They don't have very much private property, if anything. And eventually they themselves, even their own bodies, are enslaved. And when God brings them out of Egypt, he says, look, I'm going to take you to the promised land, and life is going to be very, very different than what you're used to. Farming is going to be fundamentally different. So you're no longer going to be relying on the annual flooding from the Nile River, which just kind of comes and grows all kinds of crazy foods. Instead, you're going to be trusting the Lord to bring you the rain. You're no longer going to be in a command economy where there's no private property. Instead, every family is going to get their own allotment, and you're going to be growing your own food. And you are to remember that it's the Lord who gives you these good things. And what's interesting is, in between when they leave Egypt and when they enter Canaan, they actually have to go through a process of unlearning Egypt in preparation for life in the promised land. And one of the little episodes that's really telling is when God sends the manna to feed them. And remember, these are people who built store cities, right? And what do? Even though they're told not to store any, they store the manna overnight anyway. And of course, it doesn't work out. It breeds worms and stinks. And it's just showing how deeply ingrained this idea that, like, you are not going to be okay unless you take care of yourself. That and this, you know, this is the kind of world we live in too. This is why I say this is like so relevant for us, because we live in a world where we're told constantly that anything good we have is a result of human achievement. Anything good that we have is a result, especially if you're sort of an individualistic conservative American, anything good you have is something that you go out and get for yourself. Right. Listen to Dave Ramsey, the finance expert. He praises people who, you know, kill something and drag it home, which is great. We want people to work hard. But the Sabbath has kind of this two-edged lesson to it, because there is built into the Sabbath commandment the commandment to go and labor for 6 days. But there's also the commandment to rest, and that commandment to rest on the Sabbath day and remember what God has done. And I actually think that the reason appended to the fourth commandment in Deuteronomy is super, super important here, which is 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So this idea that the Sabbath is a constant teaching to us and a constant witness to the world that we disbelieve the world's stories about where good things come from. We believe that God is the source of all of our blessing, not good luck, not hard work, not manifest destiny, not capitalism, not the will of the people, nothing except God. And so I think this is actually an incredibly important part of our witness as Christians. I actually think much more than we think it is, the Sabbath is about public witness as much as it's about private practice. And I think if we could wrap our minds around that, that'll kind of reshape the way that we practice, talk about, and look at the Lord's Day.
Daniel, I really appreciate what you're saying, and you just started talking about these are things that Christians should do. And so far, we've been talking about the Old Testament. Bring that into the New Testament for us so our listeners can understand the connection between the things you've just spoken about and our following Jesus. Of course, a lot of Christians today don't think that we should be keeping the Sabbath, so tie this together for them.
Yeah, that's a really important question. And it is a legitimate concern that a lot of people bring up, because they say, like, well, hey, you know, I'm not sure that the Sabbath, you know, the word Sabbath is ever used in the New Testament to refer to the first day of the week, what we call the Lord's Day or Sunday. What Presbyterians especially tend to refer to as the Sabbath or the Christian Sabbath. And I think that's actually correct. I don't think the term is used that way. So the question then arises, do we see the early church practicing or keeping the fourth commandment in any way? And the answer, I think, is yes, particularly in their worship practice, in their practice of worshiping on the first day of the week, that they understand this to be the way that they are called to weekly remember the Lord. And that's something that you see right from the get-go. So Jesus appears, of course, you know, Jesus rises on the first day of the week, but he also appears to his disciples when they're gathered together on the first day of the week. And then over and over again in the New Testament, what you see is where there are churches, they are gathering on the first day of the week. So it comes up in Acts and it comes up in 1 Corinthians. And Paul talks about them gathering in 1 Corinthians, for instance, he talks about them gathering to break bread on the first day of the week. And this is not subtle coded language. They are gathering to worship. And so the case I make in the book is that even when what we would call a full-blown Sabbath rest was off the table, and I think it was off the table for a lot of people, the church always remembered the Sabbath at least by gathering for worship. And when they had opportunity, what we see in the history of the church fathers, for instance, what we see referred to a number of times in various early church documents, is that as they have opportunity, they take this as their holy day. I do think it's an important thing, and I do think it's an important criticism for people to bring up, that we can't just say simply, yes, everybody just started keeping Sunday as their Sabbath. Most people wouldn't have even had the option of doing that. The ancient Jews in the Roman Empire had certain legal protections for their Sabbath that let them do that. Christians weren't even a recognized group for a long time, so they didn't have those kinds of protections. A lot of them were slaves. A lot of them were, you know, just poor people who had to work on other people's schedules. But we do see from very early on Christians resting on what was already their holy day. And from the get-go, they're keeping that holy day holy by sanctifying it with worship. And so worship is sort of that indispensable element of Sabbath keeping for Christians. Then we go out from there to the other parts, to rest, to worship, to mercy, as we have opportunity.
I think that's helpful. And I think, too, to tie some of that in, you know, to see the way the New Testament fleshes that out as well. I think, you know, some of your observations about what was happening in Exodus, what was happening with Israel in Egypt, the restlessness, and of course, Egypt can be categorized as restless because they are constantly working. There is no stopping. It is all about advance. It is all about progress. And of course, the answer to restlessness is rest. And even there, you begin to see way more of a universal theme than you would just one that can be relegated to an Old Testament time. The point, as you said, is it's God. It's God who provides these things. It's not just picking ourselves up by our bootstraps and hard work and economy. And I think, too, that your book does a good job representing that. I think this just even there, even in Israel, it was a universal principle that you know, you draw out so wonderfully, right, a nonstop schedule of work and doing our schedule and our agenda is actually enslavement. And God offers rest. He offers a break from that in order that we not be enslaved. So I think that's really important. I we need to move on. I love the whole part of your book on the why, the restlessness, the empire of anxiety. You interact a lot with some of the things that Jesus says regarding the Sabbath, even things that might surprise many of us. So I really want to commend that. But let's get a little more. You've already mentioned, but let's get a little more into some of the hows. You've already emphasized worship, which, of course, as Presbyterians, that's the non-negotiable. It is a day for worship. But your book also emphasizes feasting, rest, and mercy. You've touched on some of that. Can you just elaborate a little more I mean, I loved every section of this book, but maybe feasting and mercy especially are maybe some categories we don't always think in. That's a wide open door for you to just talk about some of the how to's.
Yeah, the feasting chapter for me was a lot of fun, partly because I like to eat, and partly because growing up, I actually felt like that was a wonderful thing that my parents did. They did a really good job of making the Lord's Day a day of joy and feasting, and they liked cooking, and they liked eating, and they liked sharing that food. And I think we need to kind of recapture this biblical understanding of festival. I think there's sort of a Northern European guilty conscience when it comes to enjoying things. So one of the examples I bring up in the book is this long-term study that was done in New Haven, Connecticut, about the drinking habits of two groups of immigrants, Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants. And what the people who were studying this discovered was that they drank about the same per capita. They drank about the same amount of alcohol, but that alcoholism was rampant among the Irish immigrants, whereas it was almost non-existent among the Italian immigrants. And so you say, how could that be? Well, it was in how and when and where they drank. And by the way, all of this is not to advocate drinking for those who don't want to do that. It's just to illustrate a point. For the Italian immigrants, they were drinking wine at almost every meal. They were drinking with family and seldom to excess. It was just food and it was joy. It was part of the joy of being together. For the Irish immigrants, the drinking was done mainly kind of in furtive secret situations. So the men would get done with work and then they would go off to the bar and drink till they were blackout drunk. And it's very interesting because I think that in a lot of ways we adopt kind of that same mindset about all pleasure. We kind of think as a pleasure as something that is private, as something that is guilty. If it's not a guilty pleasure, it's not really pleasure. And what the Bible presents for us is a very different picture of joy and pleasure, that we are called not only to labor and not only to rest in the sense of ceasing from labor sometimes, but we're also called to enjoy the fruit of our labor and to share that with others. So, I mean, if you look at the ancient laws, like for instance, some of the harvest festivals, the Lord commands through Moses, like, I want you to take 10%. I want you to take a tithe of what you produced this year and eat it that week. And you're like, well, the math is not very good if we're trying to be a little frugal here and not, you know, get ourselves a tummy ache. You wind up going, wow, that is a lot of food being consumed in a short period of time. And the reason is, yeah, you do this in honor of me, in honor of the Lord. This is a way of saying everything good that I have comes from him. And so of all times to enjoy food and enjoy time together and enjoy, there's the great word conviviality, right? Being together, life together. The Sabbath, the Lord's Day is the best time to do that because the Lord has poured out his blessings on us. And blessing means not just having something, but enjoying it. And so this whole idea, there's a fantastic book called Leisure, the Basis of Culture by a German Catholic philosopher from the mid 20th century named Joseph Pieper. And Pieper talks about this idea of leisure as being something that is as taking the form for, especially for Christians, of festival. And at the heart of festival is worship, but then surrounding worship is the festival, is the feast aspect. And so that is something that we, I think, you know, some Christians, and I know lots of Christians who have great Lord's Days. Some Christians need to maybe recover that idea that this is supposed to be a joyful day and a day where you eat the best food and you have dessert and you get people together and you enjoy that. I think that's incredibly important. And again, not to bust too much on our Westminster standards, that's not a strong suit of the Westminster standards. They don't place any kind of emphasis on joy and celebration and feasting and conviviality as part of the Lord's Day, as part of honoring the Lord's Day. And then flowing.
I think that that connects well too, just with the biblical picture, right? If we ground Sabbath in creation and after God, quote unquote, labors, after he creates, then he takes his rest and he enjoys the creation. I like how you said that, that blessing is not just having, it's also enjoying. And the Sabbath commandment, as you pointed out earlier, often it falls on the one day, but there's also 6 days. 6 days you're going to labor, do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord. And it is a time for us to step back and enjoy the labor of our hands, which comes out in the book in this picture of feasting. So I appreciated that point, but I interrupted you. Go on.
No. Just to piggyback on that, I do think we tend to think, and this goes along with this sort of culture of production and driving hard and getting up at 4:30 in the morning and, you know, getting your supplements and your exercise dialed in so that you could just be as productive as possible. I even think that we tend to think of rest as something that serves work, right? So rest, we take breaks so that we can work better when we're done with the break. We rest at night so that we can work hard during the day. We rest on the weekend or on the Lord's Day even so that we recharge our batteries so we could go back to work, right? And that's actually kind of taking a biblical understanding of work and rest and turning them upside down, because work is good, right? This work is a gift that God has given us. It's got all kinds of problems, all kinds of headaches, all kinds of things can go wrong, but it is a gift that God has given us. But rest is an even better gift that God has given us. And the eternity that we look forward to is enjoyment of God's finished work in history, which is crowning his finished work in creation. But that is something that that's what we're looking forward to, right? Eternity is not more hard work. Eternity is rest. And rest is sort of the crown of work. I think going along with that, you know, as you mentioned the mercy chapter, and in some ways, the mercy chapter is the least practical of the chapters that I have in there. And it may give some people some headaches. It's going to be interesting to see how people respond to that, because the mercy of the Sabbath day is in some ways a prophetic thing. Again, those Old Testament prophets, when they were dealing with Sabbath breaking, for instance, Isaiah chapter 58, chapters 57 and 59, it's all wrapped up together with immorality, idolatry, and oppression. And the idea here is, you know, these are people who don't want the wheels of commerce to ever stop. Same thing happens in the book of Nehemiah. I love the scene in Nehemiah where all of these non-Jewish merchants of various types, including fish vendors, which if you think about, like fish vendors coming to Jerusalem, their fish don't smell very good at that point. They're probably like dried something from the Mediterranean. They're Tyrian and Sidonian fish vendors, and they're coming to Jerusalem. They're trying to sell on the Sabbath. And Nehemiah orders that the gates be shut, and they try to wait him out. And he's like walking around fuming on the wall of the city and telling them, like, you're never getting in here. We're never doing this again. We're never breaking the Sabbath the way we used to. The big driver to breaking the Sabbath in the Old Testament, and I would argue in our time as well, is actually commerce. It's actually that if we don't rest, then our gains can snowball, right? We've invested this much time and this much money into the various things that we're doing, our various enterprises, our various projects. And when you like what you're doing, or when what you're doing is going well, it's really hard to stop. And we have a lot of disincentives from stopping. But the people who lose out, first of all, we all lose out in the long term, because even if you're enjoying it, Sabbath breaking becomes slavery. Restlessness leads to slavery. But the people who lose out the most directly are low-level workers. It's really interesting just since COVID to see how that's played out, right? It's extremely convenient for me if I'm locked up in my house in New England in early 2000 that Amazon delivers all the time. But the Amazon guys are the people who are out delivering 7 days a week. And I try to avoid that, obviously. They're the guys who are out delivering 7 days a week. They're the people in the warehouses picking and packing 7 days a week. They're the people who are having to, you know, pee in a jar in the box truck and because they don't have enough time to take breaks. Those are the people that lose out. And wealthy people, which is most of us to some extent, we have a lot of choices for when we rest. Not so wealthy people don't have a lot of choices for when they rest. And so I actually think, and this is kind of, I'm trying to kind of turn some of the conversations that I've seen within the Presbyterian world about Sabbath keeping on their heads. Because a lot of times, you know, when I was coming up through seminary, I had a lot of friends who took what they called the, you know, they nicknamed it the Calvin Klein view of the Sabbath after John Calvin. It's not actually a very good representation of Calvin, but maybe a representation of Meredith Klein, taking this very, the Sabbath is for us, not for the world kind of view, where they say, look, I am resting by going and eating at a restaurant on a Sunday, right? I am resting and my wife doesn't have to cook and it's great for everybody. And the people that are the wait staff, you know, that's their problem, right? They should be Christians, I guess, or they should decide. And it's like, no, you got this exactly wrong. These are the people who actually need the rest the most. And you, by electing to employ them when you don't have to, and I understand it's sometimes it's difficult to completely extract ourselves from commerce, but by choosing to employ them and get them working on a Sunday, you're actually enforcing the difficulty of their lives. You're actually making things just a little bit worse for them than they have to. And I tend to think we think about these things backwards. But yeah, the mercy and the Sabbath are incredibly closely related. The Sabbath teaches us that God, not mammon, right? That's Jesus's word for money. It's sort of money personified, money with a capital M, Mr. Money. God, not mammon, is the giver of rest and help, right? And that's something that both wealthy people and poor people just as much need to hear, because we're all told by the world that we live in that if you just made more money, everything would be okay. And it also demonstrates for us the fundamental equality of people before God.
And, you know, one of the things you're making me think of, I had an interesting experience on Memorial Day. I was invited to a Chinese picnic, and it was Chinese restaurant workers. I've befriended some of them, and they're Christians. But it was interesting. They work on the Lord's Day, and then they have Bible studies online at night for fellowship on Sunday night. But then they took Memorial Day off in order to have this picnic with one another. They closed down their restaurants. And I was thinking, now we got to get them to think of that, not on an annual basis, but on a weekly basis with the true Memorial Day. And I'm actually praying for them that way, because they're dear people, but they're constantly working. And I think they're missing out on so much.
Yeah, that's a super, first of all, people are obviously different, you know, even Christians are at different places as far as their readiness to think about things in those terms. But it's also, you know, one of the things I talk about a little bit in the book is people are in different situations, and some people are in situations where stopping, not working on the Lord's Day, this is the kind of thing that could get me in trouble all over again, I guess. Some people are in a situation where that is actually not a good option. That is not a realistic option. You're in a down economy. This is the only job you can get. And the choice is no job or a job that forces you to work Sundays. Work Sundays. I mean, it stinks, and you should get free of that as soon as you can. Yeah. It's kind of like what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, where he says, hey, if you're a slave, don't let it bother you. But if you can get your freedom, get your freedom. Mm-hmm. And if your need to work on the Lord's Day, that's at some level, that's a kind of slavery. So we want to be super But at the same time, we want to be super sympathetic and super patient with people who are in that kind of situation. And also encourage, there are some who are saying, well, you know, I'm really going to lose a lot of business if I don't do that. It's like, well, how much business are you going to lose? We're going to have to work on that together.
Well, this has been wonderful. I know we're up against the clock. Daniel, I want to really thank you for this interview today. Again, to our listeners, I want to just very personally commend this book in very high terms. I absolutely loved it. Daniel, you know that. I've gushed about it. I will continue very to gush about it. Daniel, you open your book simply by saying, keeping the Sabbath means resting on the day of God's choosing and sharing that rest with others as much as it depends on us. That simple sentence, then you continue to unpack throughout that book. And I heartily recommend it to our listeners. Want to thank you very much for coming in and interviewing about it and wish you the most success with this. Just real quick, were the first interview you've done on this book?
I talked about it just a little bit with the Blue Banter guys, but I think other than that, they got a little sneak preview, but first full interview. So,
well, good. Well,
thank you.
I do hope that you get many more invitations to our listeners. We do have, or we will have, 3 copies of this book to give away. Per our usual, feel free to email us at 3gt.xyz@gmail.com. The first 3 people to claim a copy of this book, we will make sure that a copy gets sent to you. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. That way you will get notified every time a new episode drops so that you never miss your favorite podcast, 3 Guys Theologizing. Thanks for tuning in today.